Keep in mind the big outline. We talk about the old creation created, the nature of the creation. Now we're looking at the old creation corrupted, the fall, the entrance of sin. And let me share with you something that's on my mind, which is at least peripherally attached to this. It's an experience I had this week, which I think is bears comments, interesting to me. I was asking. I got an invitation last week to an invitation to lecture on at Rollins College, a class on creation science. The history core class, they're studying history of Darwinism. The professor was the typical university type, undergraduate type, which I, which he personifies everything I can't stand in a professor. Looked like he slept in his clothes, didn't wear a tie, called out of bed, and his mind was in the same shape. And that's the kind of pseudo-intellectual. Anyway, I didn't know that until I got there. Not sure what my standard teaching uniform. I was kind of like a student that's there anyway. But they had what they had last week, week before. Last week they had an evolutionist, because they're saying Darwinism from a historical perspective, they had an evolutionist coming. They turned down and found out it was a Sealing Grace, it was the Central American team and anthropologists. That was my view of diversity. My view of sly. He never heard me, but anyway, and so then I was presenting the other side on what they were expecting. It was interesting that that the coming of the murder, this shows the nature of sin, that I presented the basic structure, the basic standing of the argument, the issues are in the question of the origin of matter, prebiotic evolution, and organic evolution. They anyway pointed out basically that every year hundreds of the world's best scientists are coming to creations. And why? Basically, what I demonstrated in several books. Examples of this, and read an excerpt from it. Well, it's an interesting thing happened that there was a, among the professor, from the professor and some of the students, there was this emotional, philosophical panic almost among the students. The idea of course, they raised the standard arguments, and I'd heard them all before, so I waited for them. And as they saw the foundations of their belief system eroding, you'd be amazed how academic objectivity evaporated. Couldn't even the professor. It got down to, well, they didn't know, if I put it in these words, they would have objected, but this is exactly the position that they were taking. What happens? I'll lecture for 45 minutes, then we have about another half hour, 45 minutes of this give and take. And what happened was that the students, some of the students, many of them, most of them, and who spoke up, and the professor, it got down to, well, we'll believe anything before we'll accept divine creation. Like one student even said, well, I kept pointing out that and they got irrational. One of them said, well, you should present both sides. And just let us make up our mind that my side was presenting one side. I asked him, I said, well, did Dr. Grace, did he argue for creation? You know, real quiet. Of course he did. You know, but somehow it's okay for him to present one side, but they would be better. They wanted me to present both sides, but the side I was presenting. You know, well, something like, there may be some other explanation. You know, I pointed out, you know, the old philosopher's dictum, there's only so many men in the room. There are not an infinite number of possibilities. And one student said that, said, well, you know, anything could have happened. And I said, that's absolutely not true. There's not too many anything can happen. My point is that here you see the nature of sin. And the longer I was in, when I was working in the world of secular academics, my college, the more I appreciated Romans chapter 1, where they refuse to have God in their knowledge. That unbelief is not an act of intellect in the sense of being pushed by the objective evidence. Unbelief is fundamentally an act of the will. Men do not want to have God in their knowledge. I said, my final comment on that one was, I said, well, if you want to believe that somewhere out there in some hypothetical dream world there's an explanation of cause that's neither natural nor supernatural, that's my understanding of that. I said, we might believe that, but don't call it science. But it was really disheartening to me. I went out there very depressed, because here were the professor and her students, very bright people, who, when faced with argument they could not overcome and evidence they could not ignore, became very fundamentalist. That is, they became secular fundamentalists. They simply said, well, I don't care if it says it's like, I don't care what the evidence is. I'll believe anything. Well, except God. Of course, many are doing that. Fred Hoyle, you know, with his book, The Intelligent Universe, adopted for a view called panspermia, that somehow the universe itself is intelligent, like a Hindu. The universe itself is intelligent. The brain is intelligent, so that almost like it does. But I just thought it would be interesting to you. But one thing that struck me is that the level of academics that was practiced, that came through in that set of settings, the kind of we would never tolerate. Professor, regardless of the content of his faith, professor, it was that sloppy in his dress and that sloppy in his thinking. It could not last a week here. And I'm telling you this because you students here are getting a more liberal education than they're getting at Rollins College or any university. By liberal, I mean you are forced to face both sides of the issue. For instance, in the class where this really comes in, apologetics, in chambers, you are forced, are you not, to seriously address the other side. You can't just dismiss it with a wave of the hand and say, well, that's silly. But on the other side of the fence, that doesn't happen. You don't want it to happen. So liberal, in the good sense, is to look honestly at all arguments. I must not tell you that. Just terribly sloppy. And what happened Monday, I'm convinced because I've been in this situation more than once, is that they were thrown off balance because they had Dr. Brace in. And one of the things he said was, are y'all interested in this? You ought to be. One of the things he said that in the field of anthropology, which is human fossil evidence, especially, he said, well, in our field, we don't talk much about evolution, you know. And I told him why. Because the discipline is an absolute chaos. Every time they find a new skull, they rewrite all the books. Because what the hypothesis has predicted is absolutely not being found in the fossil evidence. Because in this field, I wouldn't talk much about evolution either. That's exactly those words. That was my field. That's the field of evolution which I've been special training. So what they were expecting was to have Dr. Brace, you know, this pure scientist, come in and they're going to have fundamentalists come in and have it for lunch. I say that to show you the level of the mentality. The little intellectual level of that class. They're going to send, on this Friday, he's telling me, they're going to sum up the whole thing by showing the movie Inherit the Wind. You ever seen the movie Inherit the Wind? Well, it's about this, it's Hollywood, it's about the Scopes trial in Tennessee, in which Spencer Tracy plays Clarence Darrow. And I forget who played it, we didn't get it right. But well, I've seen the movie for the time. It's a caricature in which it comes out. Creation side looks like an absolute buffoon. Of course, Spencer Tracy, you know, he comes out like, you know, and the evolution side is horrible and spectacle. And so since then, I really have been infuriated because to show that movie as if that would have something to do with the issue is absurd. It's worse than absurd. It's absurdly absurd. So I was angry, so I just undermined the movie during my lecture. I didn't do it. I'm very clear that that's the kind of nonsense that doesn't matter to do. But I found one thing that the professor had not done his homework. And he tried to, when it got too bad, when they were going to eat, I think they were going to, they decided they were going to, he thought they were going to have 10 minutes for lunch. And when it got so bad that the students were starting to panic, he himself, he tried to debate me a little bit. And he was just very strange things. But without going any further, I just, my thing that brings it to mind is we're going to be studying in this nature of sin, what sin does, the effects of sin, different things we're getting into that. And you must understand is that when the effects of sin, sin destroys reason. That unbelief is a philosophical thing. No, it's not thinking of it. And their attitude is very, very disheartening. And if you have any questions on that, I'll share that with you. I think I'm so depressed, I have to go out and get myself out to breakfast. Okay, well, look at the nature of sin. The fall of man. At the top of page 11, this is somewhat hypothetical and not as important as some of the other things we'll study, but important enough to include it. This is the history of theology. Theologians ask the question, was it possible for Adam not to sin? Passe non peccari. Now, I put this, if people are going to ask you this kind of question in your local ministries, and maybe it, to show you how, but it does have a history of discussion, I give you the Latin for it. Calvin said that it was not possible for man to sin because of the eternal decree of God. We would expect Calvin to say that, wouldn't we? Would we not? Secondly, Adam had free will. It was possible, therefore, for him to not sin as to sin. Was it possible for Adam to not sin? I say yes, it was possible for him to not sin. He had free will, could have gone either way. Now, that seems to be implicit in the whole business. If that is not true, then what was the significance of the temptation? I'm sorry, of the probation? What was the significance of this whole thing of God telling Adam, if you can't eat of this tree? Was it just a charade? No. Did Adam have the power of opposite choice? That's what free will means. Genuine free will. The answer is yes. If he did not have the power of opposite choice, then the whole business is meaningless. This is a possibility that we enjoy only theoretically. We had a professor, one of the early years in the school, we had a guest speaker come to chapel and preach a sermon in which he said that it was possible to live without sinning. I'm writing a series of essays on the lookout and on Romans. It's a lesson in life, that section on the lookout on series of Romans coming up. And one of them, we talked about it, was the doctrine of sin, man in Romans. And in writing this, I was reminded of a Benjamin Franklin, who, and I'm this is an essay, you can look at it, but Benjamin Franklin, he was a race Presbyterian, but he was a deist. So he decided that he was going to live a perfect life. He was going to achieve moral, as he put it, moral perfection. His autobiography tells about it. So he said, since he knew the right, or thought he knew the right, and had free will, that he, by setting up a definite program, that he would achieve moral perfection. So he made up a law. He made up a log in which he drew up a list of 13 comprehensive virtues. And they weren't a pretty good list. And which if he kept these, if he incorporated these virtues into his life as habits, then he would live a moral and perfect life. And then after he drew up his list of 13 virtues, he worked out a daily log. And so what he said was, it's too hard to work on every virtue at the same time. So what he'd do is he'd take virtue number one and concentrate on that until he had a down pat. And then when he had that mastered, then he'd move on to virtue number two. The idea being, when he got through all 13 virtues, he would live the morally perfect life, which, as a matter of fact, is probably true. If you look at the list of virtues, pretty well thought out. So, and he tells how he made this. That what he would do is he would put down, and he would, on this log, he would list his shortcomings, record of his sin, his shortcomings, and then his faults, he put it. And then he would, and when he had gone a day without a fault, without that fault, he just a ledger, like a CPA. When he lived a day without that fault, he'd mark it out. See? And then eventually, as he added these virtues and erased the faults, eventually be a morally perfect. Wow, he's very serious. And he said, because he found out, he had a real problem, though. His book kept getting tattered because he had to keep putting his faults back in. He was erasing them and putting them back in and marking them out. So he finally he made the mistake originally of putting them in ink. And he soon had holes in his ledger. He had to scrape out, his mark and his erasers. So finally he went to a pencil. Went to a lead pencil so he could erase it. And finally he threw his book away. Why? Well, as I worded his pride became as tattered as his record book. He found out, he said he couldn't do it. He makes this amazing statement. It was harder, I found it to be harder than I thought it would be. And I thought, yeah, we could have told you that, couldn't we? This is the question. Is it this possibility to live without sin? Do we know the right? Pretty well. Do we have free will? Yes. Then why not? That's his thinking. If I know the right and can do the right, why can I not live the morally perfect life? Well, this is Socrates. Socrates, said that if a man knew the right, he could do the right. Therefore, the problem is education. You have to learn the right. Now, that, by the way, also is modern humanism. It always amazes me that whatever social problem comes up, the humanist waves the magic wand over it called education. How are we going to do away with teenage pregnancies and the spread of STD, socially transmitted diseases? But more education. I'll tell you, if we get much more sex education, we're all going to be wiped out. And the basic, the thing is, what you do is you get these kids in there and teach them how to use birth control methods, and we'll stop some of this. What have they found? Does it work? Doesn't work. Why? They don't do it.
But under all this, is this? And it's not just in there in sex; it's in there, all kinds of areas. Why is it that the government's rehabilitation program in the prisons is apt as a 98% failure?
Or something way on, it's a little high.
A high 87% failure. Why? Well, see, it's based on this assumption that to know the right, if a man knows the right, he'll do the right. So you got to just teach him the facts. We could have, and just like Mr. Franklin's error, we could have told him a long time ago that it won't work. Now we're going to come back why later. Understand? I make a note to be discussed later. I'm just making this point here, to which we will return in detail, deal with it systematically, is that this possibility to live without sin is only theoretical. As a matter of fact, we are tainted, we are corrupted. Sin, we're going to see, sin reproduces after its own kind. Sin, as we're going to discuss in detail, is not only a momentary act that produces guilt before God and perhaps guilt in our conscience, but a particular sin, paves the way, opens the door for more of its own kind. Sin not only has its immediate effect in the mind of God and in our person, but sin creates the tendency to sin. Okay. Some have suggested, you understand what we're saying here? So it's only theoretically possible. I think Mr. Franklin was naive, and so is anybody else. Modern humanists are naive. Just give them the facts, educate them. No, people do not need more of the facts. They need a moral, they need to be born again. I laugh at the idea that education about drugs is going to have very much effect on the use of drugs. For the simple reason that drug users already know all about drugs. Let me ask you, it's like education. My son is at the SAD, Students Against Drunk Driving program in school. Does anybody really think, does any of you really think that any student entering the junior class, sophomore class at Winter Park High School doesn't know that liquor makes you drunk? Does any of them really not know that if you get drunk and get in a car, you can kill yourself? If you actually sit down and say to the students, if you know the liquor makes you drunk, if you get drunk and drive, you're right. Then they're going to say, you never knew that. You can't do it. Make them get that bad. You say, the drunk, you say, no, they already know it. And he doesn't need education. All he needs is a dad to draw a line on him. Or to have a new heart. Understand? The problem is not the facts. They got the facts. They know what's going on. Drug users know exactly what's going on. Let me ask you this. Do any of you not know what causes babies? If you don't know, I'll be glad to meet with you privately. Tell you. I mean, y'all knew. How long have you known? Yeah, you've known. As soon as you needed to know, you knew, right? But you've known that for a long time. Your contemporary people your age, they know. I'm not education. Problem is moral, spiritual, not intellectual. As Mr. Franklin found out. Well, some suggest that if Adam had passed the test, he would have been in a state of non-possificare, not possible to sin. Some posit this as the state of the redeemed in eternity. We've already talked about that. I don't. At least because I think theoretically it will be possible to sin in eternity. Theoretically. Why? So, in only insofar as we will still have free will. You got that? Some suggest that if Adam had passed this test, he would enter the state where he could not have sinned. I think that's ridiculous. Why? What does it just defies the whole character and purpose of the creation, which is that God would have children. When they have children, they have free will. Now, what would have happened, though? Did I talk in here? I think I did. You tell me if I did. About what if Adam had not sinned? Would he have died? Did I talk in here? What do you think?
Suppose out of the nonsense, it could possible for him. Only theoretically possible for him. He would have died. He'd still be around. What was the penalty for his sin? The day that you eat of it, you shall die.
I still wonder about the tree of life, though. Is he able to eat from the tree of life? Because the warning comes afterwards, let's get him out of here before he does eat of the tree of life.
Eternal physical life is neither possible nor desirable after his fall. If he had not sinned, he'd still be around. Anybody want to guess? That's an awful question for 8 o'clock in the morning. What do you think? Well, we don't know for in the first place. It's pure speculation. Second place, some have suggested that I like this suggestion. I don't know if it has any value or not, but I like it. And that is, some have suggested that Adam had not sinned, that he would have gone into eternity without. Dying physically. Is there any precedent for that in Scripture? Sure. But remember, Enoch walked with God, was not, but God took him. He was translated. And what's the second one? Elijah. And there's one more. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. I worded it very carefully. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. So you have at least three examples. Number one is Enoch. Number two is Elijah. Number three is all those who are alive, Christians who are alive when the Lord returns. They will immediately go from this life into that life without physical death to be translated. So, that makes sense to me, that possibility, that if Adam had not sinned, he would have been translated when God chose to do it. Okay. Now, I can't.
You mean before or after the offspring?
Whenever. Whenever, yeah. Now, I said, that makes sense to me. That doesn't mean that that's true. That's all speculation. It's useless anyway because, as a matter of fact, he did sin.
What? If that's the ultimate goal of everybody, is to dwell eternally with God in some sort of sense like that, being translated, then what was the purpose of God creating a physical world?
That's an excellent question, Bush. The two sides to that. One is, there are two possibilities. In other words, the first question is, was the world that was originally created like this world, in the sense, by that I mean, was it subject to the second law of thermodynamics? Was it a dying world, or was it an eternal world? Now, some hold that the curse is the second law of thermodynamics, corruption, which came as a result of the sin, and that the whole world was cursed, and that that the new heavens and the new earth have to replace the original one, and it will be basically the same thing, a world that doesn't die. But that man, this whole, the sin of man tainted the whole creation, maybe destroy the whole idea, as it were. So God, so the redemption includes the redemption of the heavens and earth. We're going to come to this later in this course. Now, I like that view. That's my view. That he was not created, put here just to go there. Saying he was created here and could have stayed here in an undying world. But we would not have needed a new earth and a new heavens. The old one would serve very well originally. Now, the alternative to that view is that the curse only touched certain aspects of the creation. And that is that from the very beginning, and I think this is possible, and maybe the right answer, my faith isn't tied to either one of them, that the original creation was subject to the law of thermodynamics, was a decaying creation. And then if you ask the question, well, why would God put man who would not sin on a decaying world? And I think the answer, if that's what he did, and I think it's very possible it's what he did, and we're going to translate him from it. See, we said this before, when at appropriate time. Then the answer to that is in the foreknowledge of God. That is, he simply knew what was going to happen. And since he knew what man was going to do, he was going to sin, the original creation reflected his foreknowledge. Are you understanding what I'm saying? So that he did not need to commit himself to an undying universe, because he knew that it was going to have to be destroyed anyway, because he knew that man was going to sin. And I'm comfortable with either one of those. And both of them, I think, have good scriptural grounds. They're based on deduction. You can draw deductions from scripture and support either one of them. For instance, does the Bible break? Now, don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying that the curse did not touch the physical creation. It did. The question is how much of it and in what way. The Bible doesn't explain that. We know it touched part of it, changed much of it. Whether it changed the whole thing or not is another question. Now, do you understand what he asked? Are you understanding my answer? I'm sure you do. This is a good question to be answered. So, on the other hand, is there scriptural evidence, is there scriptural precedent for saying that God does act on the basis of his foreknowledge? Well, it certainly does. The whole redemptive plan of redemption is there. That is, God manipulates history, as it were. He does things based upon his foreknowledge. For instance, I'll give you an example to raise this question. Jesus is called the Lamb of God, crucified from the foundations of the world. Did God know before the creation there was going to be the cross? He did. And he created the world anyway. Do you know what I'm saying? So, and I'm not saying that the world was here just as a probation. The second view would sort of lean toward that. That is, he knew what man was going to do, so he gives him a place of probation. Well, I think there's some truth involved in that. The kicker in that is, if you saw the words just as, it wasn't that nothing else. That's right, my problem. I think it was not that nothing else. Now, the first view simply says that when man fell, God cursed the whole creation, and it became a dying creation. Which I think is very possible.
Romans, where it talks about the whole creation growing.
Suffering under the curse, exactly right.
Until it's made right again, you know, and you first be back to the way it was when it created.
Yes. Now, remember I told you I like the first view. It seems to make more sense to me. Now, I wouldn't set up all my defendants. You know, I would, somebody, I just don't think we have that much information. It doesn't affect the scheme of redemption as I see it. For one thing, Butch, One thing that makes me lean in that direction is the language of the consummation. That is, you know, the Bible does not actually say we're going to go to spend eternity in heaven. That's an inference. Nothing wrong with that language. I don't get excited, upset about it. You know, heaven is, we speak of heaven as we have an inheritance eternal in the heavens. It's reserved for us. Heaven is sometimes means the dwelling place of God, and we're going to go be with God. So this is a natural, it's a very natural way to speak, and I think an accurate way to speak. But technically, at least for now, but the language of the Bible, what does the Bible call the situation where we are going to spend eternity? It's called the new heavens and the new earth. It's called that revelation, it's called it Peter.
Now, I have heard people talk about, because of the way it's phrased in the Bible, it can be taken different ways, that you have a part of new creation when we're baptized, even though we are still the same person, but we are a new creation. And it talks about how when Christ comes back, we're in a new body. Now, and I've always, had in mind a totally different, maybe my sense of the lottery, because that's how I've always been taught. But then I've heard people say, you talk about a new creation, but you're still some different person. What about when we're in a new body, if it's just going to be, we're just going to be improved, or, what I'm saying? But we're going to still be here on the earth, and we'll be like the Garden of Eden.
Well, first of all, the Bible says we're a new creation. It's a metaphor. New birth is a metaphor. Circumcision is a metaphor. Remember the metaphors. And we are not a new creation metaphysically. We're a new creation spiritually. And when we talk about a new creation, it speaks of not of our condition, but of our situation. We're in Christ, in the mind of God. The actual metaphysical change will come when Jesus returns. That's when we have the new body. So let's be careful. We don't even understand that. Okay. Now, we're going to talk more about that later. Keep saying that, but we really are. Now, secondly, what we have, and I think I said this before when the question came up, that when we talk about the relation, what is the relation between this body and that body? It is discontinuity in substance, but continuity in identity. We will not be this body as we know it, but it will still be us. Now, I don't have no idea how that's going to work, but the Bible affirms that. The answer is very simple. We just don't know what it is. Okay. Now, are you with me? Okay. Now, and the connection between this and what we're talking about, the question of which raised, is that, remember I said I like the language is new heavens and new earth. Why is it called that? Well, I think there is the same, just as there's a connection between what we are now, but is there that what we will be in eternity in our new bodies, we will still be us. There will be this continuity of identity. And I think that same relationship, the language tells me, that same relationship exists between the new heavens and the new earth and the old earth. That is, it will be a restoration. That's the Bible. The Bible speaks of the restoration of all things. It's a biblical language. The restoration of all things. So, at least in some sense, and maybe in the same sense, that our new body is a restoration of this body, only corruption will put on incorruption. There will be a discontinuity of substance, a continuity of identity. So it'll be heavens and earth. In that sense, at least in some sense at least, the new heavens and new earth is a restoration of what we lost. Whatever we lost in Adam, we get back in Christ. Which suggests that the original creation was incredible. Doesn't prove it. I don't think. Maybe some say it does. Do you see what I'm saying? Now, am I touching what you're asking?
I'm so confused on. I always thought, the earth can be destroyed and we're going to be on live in heaven. But is it possible then that there's going to be a heaven and there's going to be an earth still?
Well, heavens, when the Bible says new heavens and new earth, it speaks of the universe. we're going to have a new universe. Now, and it's interesting, the book of Revelation, although he saw a vision, he didn't see the thing itself. He saw a vision, a symbolic representation of the thing. He said that the tabernacle of God is with men. It doesn't say we're going to go up to the throne room of God and live. It says he's going to come down there with us. Tabernacle of God. So the holy city, New Jerusalem, descending from heaven. This is the church, not a physical city. And behold, the tabernacle of God is with them. He'll dwell with them, wipe away their tears. He said, I am being. He'll be their God on the new heavens and the new earth. And again, what do we see in the garden? Do you remember how God walked with Adam in the cool of evening? Because God came down with the man. And to be with man down is a misleading term. God came. So, the whole tenor of Scripture suggests restoration, which suggests the character of the original. Now, whether it was, and that's why I like that view. I wouldn't insist upon it. I think one of the things that, and I think it's involved. Are you interested in that, y'all? Interested in this? I think speculation, and it's not really empty speculation. It's sound. It's, I think, it's speculation of some foundation. But I think we need to think about this. I think this fact of continuity of identity is speaks to it. By that, here's what I mean by that. A man has sort of an inbred appreciation or awareness of two things. Number one, a man has an inbred he has a God-shaped niche. He has an inbred awareness of the supernatural. Man is, as one philosopher put it, man is incurably religious. And I point that it's like those kids over at Rollins. They were very religious. When you say, well, I still believe that there's some force yet to be discovered which will, it's not God, that will supply the explanation of cause, that's a very religious thing to say. You talk about faith, but that's faith in the non-rational sense. That's not faith, that's a blind leap in the dark. You can't get more religious than that. I'm not that religious. I said, my professor at the university one time, I didn't have enough faith in evolution. He's more faith than I've got. But anyway, so we have that. Secondly, we have an innate appreciation of the natural order. That is, we tend to, unless somebody has no experience of nature, country, the open. Somebody's born in the ghetto and has never. I recall a friend of mine one time brought a boy from the ghetto in Chicago out to the farm and saw a butterfly and ran screaming in terror of the butterfly. Well, you've never seen a butterfly. But most people have. Is there not a general agreement, for instance, in the state of Florida? And it doesn't matter whether you're liberal or conservative, Republican, Democrat, or atheist, or communist, or whatever. There's a general concern for the environment. Why? We like nature in its natural state. We appreciate that. We desire that. We like to go to the park. I have a fellow, a good friend of mine up in Hamilton, who's got bad sugar diabetes, and he's lost his legs and amputated. And on Bill Hunter. I forget the first time we got built. I finally got into the Lord's table a few years ago. And he never prayed in public. And I encouraged him. I got at the Lord's table to pray. I'll never forget the best communion prayer I ever heard. He got up there and he said, Lord, I don't know what I'm doing here. I thought, that's right. What are we doing here? Who has the right? Who should be here? Well, anyway, Bill asked me one time, he said, will we go fishing in heaven? Did he go fish? Bill loves to fish. I mean, some people love to fish, but he loves to fish. And he asked me, could we go fishing in heaven? And I told him, yes. I can't imagine heaven, Bill being in heaven. To him, it wouldn't be heaven. He couldn't go fishing. Now, I'm not sure about that, but God will forgive me if I was wrong. I'm just expressing an opinion. My point is that the new, if we have this continuity of identity, not only are we going to be, we'll still be the same people. We'll still be who we are. We'll still like the same things. Therefore, for instance, would you be happy in some kind of cartoon-like, wispy, ethereal existence where you sit around for eternity on clouds and pluck the harp? No, that's not what we are. Yeah. We are people, for instance, I'm just utterly convinced, Renee, that we're going to live in houses, walk on roads, sit in trees, and work, and develop, and learn, and be together. No, not physical in this sense, but it'll be a body, a definite body. It'll be a time-space body. Well, maybe not a time body. I don't know. But there will be. We will have a body, a heavenly body. He says, "What it involves." But we're not going to enjoy some kind of non-material, omnipresent kind of existence. We're going to be locatable.
But I can imagine work without being physical, you know?
But it will be physical, in a sense. At least in... Pick up things.
Sorry.
So, understand? It's going to be a world that we'll recognize. With all the back to be immortal and all the bad stuff gone. Yes?
If John gives the dimensions of a new heaven and earth, or a new earth, and gives gates, do you think we'll be going in and out of the city?
No, I don't think that should be taken literally. Look at the language. This is apocalyptic language. This is oriental imagery, Jim, my opinion. And it's indicated, it's like Ezekiel's temple. What the Orientals would do is they would...
Have been the Babylon.
He'd have probably ended up marrying her and getting a new wife.
I don't know. That's a stupid...
I have taught for 13 years, and that's got to be the stupidest... No, it really isn't. I don't know.
Thank you.
I think that it
is. All your life, that answer.
No, your question, not this one. It's kind of all the questions you ask over the years together. Adds up to stupidity. No, that's not true. I don't really know. And I don't care to.
I'm just going to be curious about that.
Don't you ever put it in your mind? Well, yeah, these are legitimate questions. And you, because, yeah, but you can play what if forever.
Yeah, I know.
I think she'd have died and Adam would have been translated. Maybe.
Huh?
Yeah. By the way, let me say this. Before we begin, this is tangential to what we're talking about, with ties into something I talked about the first hour. The evolution. You know, the latest, you've been showing that in this field of genetics, that the latest scholarship is, I love this, that all human beings now on the earth descended from one pair. And not all that far back. This came out. Have you seen this? This came out. I've got this. Would you mention seeing that?
Sure.
Come to a decision about it.
Just
ask
what your thinking was. Do you think Adam and Eve had belly buttons?
No.
And why?
Adam had a scar on his side. Unless, when God created him, he said, "You're done." The answer is no. I'm sure about that. I'm definitely sure about that. I'll defend that. Did you ever have the feeling a class got away from you? Any other stupid?
That was legitimately stupid.
And now, there was a very brief article. It's come out before. It's come out 2 or 3 times. What's happened is the latest approach to evolution is the molecular approach. And what they're trying to do is trace genetic distances, like on computers. There's a genetic distance between chimpanzees and man. All it is, it's just the old morphological argument or comparative anatomy in a different shape. It doesn't prove anything. One thing that has come out of it is they have shown that they realized. See, the question that evolutionists all have debated is, did humans evolve in one place or in more than one place? There's data between the Mesopotamia and East Africa, some say Asia. Did the divergence between pongids and hominids, one line which became man, another apes or simians, did that happen only one place? Well, but the result is the affirmation that all the human race are descended from one parent. There's some genetic extrapolations on the computer. We already knew that. Of course, you'd have to descend from one parent. What is known about genetics has predicted that all along. And sort of worked it out in mathematics.
That was on PBS last night.
It was? What was it? What was said?
That's what they said, that everybody came from one parent. They had a big deal about how the blood of a human, or the DNA or something, they fixed it down, was this close to a chimpanzee and this far away from the baboon. So the split was like 5 million years ago for the chimpanzee and the human, instead of 20 million years ago,
and
everybody was all excited.
Yeah. Those are called cladograms. This cladistic approach, cladograms, they form to show the distance. Of course, the problem with those is that you have to read the theory, you have to program the theory in before you can get it out. And the second thing is, it depends on which chemicals you choose, chemical distances. You can show some that man is chemically close in some ways to a turnip, whatever, you know, it depends on what you use. And also the interesting thing is that physiologically man is closer to the orangutan. That's the closest physiologically than the chimpanzee is to the chimp. The real problem with that is, if you're interested in thinking, I'll tell you what the problem might be. The two creationist responses to that. Number one is that that's just the old morphological argument. That is, that the fact to find that you have DNA, just, you know, closeness, blood types, for instance, which is similar to other creatures. And other chemicals and other things were similar to other, compare other physiological organs or particulars. It lines up with different things. Depends on what you compare it to. And that's just the comparative anatomy. It doesn't show evolution. It shows a common creator. The second thing that is, and this is the real problem that the evolutionists had, is that the man and the chimp are too close. That is, if you check that, if you take those things to the logical conclusion, that since they're physiologically so close, why are they intellectually and culturally so, how can you cannot count this vast gap? But the theory of evolution, as you know, man is much more complex than the theory permits him to be. And the theory predicts, and all that is predicts, the model predicts, that there will be very little difference. This distance between chimps and me, as a matter of fact, the distance is vast.
They said there was something like the genetic makeup of the chimp and the human was 98.7% identical.
And why are they so different? And how do you understand? Too close.
But then
there's difference. Vast. They tried to close this gap, but man, the difference is unbelievable. The real problem is, I say, they'll admit this, the real problem they have trying to make that thing into evolutionary theory is, they got all the other problems that evolution has, but they got that problem, it was too close.
No.
They don't say we came from them. That's not what they're saying. Nobody says today that modern man came from any existing pongids, but that pongids and man had common ancestors. And the recent diversion between what they're saying is the pongid hominid diversion in the past, in the late Miocene period or however we were talking to, it happened when that the line that led to chimps diverged, the last line to diverge from whatever became man was the line that led to the chimps. That's what they're saying. So that there's the closer, so that man is genetically closer to the chimp than he is any other pongid. Okay, let's get back to soteriology. I don't regret our getting like we're talking about. These are problems and questions that I think legitimate questions that pretend, which come out of it's coming out of the question of Adam and Eve and the nature of things. What would have happened? They had not sinned, this kind of thing. So those are good questions. I don't feel bad at it. Any others before we move on? I don't want to shut down the discussion. Although I don't believe that this discussion about the belly button took place in the student lounge at all. I just want you to know that. I think that's apocryphal. The story is banished or told. Is it really take place? I'm giving my life to teaching people to debate Adam's belly button. See, what happened was Adam came home one day and Eve got the suggestion, wondering where he'd been, and he was having a woman on the side. So she, as we learned in the history and logic of science, she decided she'd try the method of authority to see if he were being unfaithful to her. So she asked him if he had a girlfriend. He said no. She didn't really want to. She wanted to accept it on the basis of authority of his word. So she decided to be scientific. So when she went to sleep, she counted his ribs. She's missing another one. You said ooh. Ogham, did you say ooh?
Well, I'm glad to hear it, because I thought you were asleep.
The time lapse between creation and temptation, apparently a brief time, and apparently before the birth of their first children. That's a minor point. This is really getting into a study in Genesis. But the Bible does not give us a chronology. How long? The Bible seems to suggest a comparatively brief time between creation and temptation. It could have been a vast amount of time. Although not vast, it could have been a long time. It says, when Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness. Now, how long before, this is Genesis 5:3, the question is, how long before that did the fall take place? And did the fall take place after the children were born or before? It doesn't say that. It does not say that the fall took place before the children were born. All it says is that because of the fall, Eve would suffer pain in childbirth. It is possible that the fall took place after they started their family. Children were born. We've got to know that. Well, it's not that important, but come to the temptation itself. Let's look at Genesis 3, 1 through 7. Now the serpent, or serpent, Nephesh, was more crafty than any beast of the field which the Lord God had made. He said to the woman, indeed, has God said, you shall not eat from any tree of the garden? The woman said to the serpent, or to serpent, from the fruit of the trees of the garden you may eat, but from the fruit of the tree which is in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, from it, or touch it, lest you die. And the serpent said to the woman, you shall surely not die, for God knows in the day you eat from it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing, that is, yada, knowing by experience, good and evil. When the woman saw the tree was good for food, that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was desirable to make one wise, she took from its fruit and ate, and she gave it also to her husband with her, and he ate. And the eyes of both of them were opened. That's an idiom. It doesn't mean they were blind before, like puppies. And they saw that they were naked. Knew that they were naked. They sewed fig leaves together and made themselves loin coverings. Now, what is the... First of all, I point to the possibility that serpent was a personal name. It's a possibility that it says... Now, because Satan is called this later on, dragon or serpent. Well, what about the snake, as you call the curse? Is part of the curse, the snake crawled on his belly? It may be, and we often picture this in our minds, as Satan coming to Eve in the body of a serpent. I don't think that's necessarily true at all. What may have happened, that may be what happened, what may have happened is that because of this name, this personal name, he's given the name serpent. Or maybe he got this name later, and maybe Moses gives him. You understand whether he was called that in the garden? We don't know. This may have been the name that was applied later to him. It may be that Satan just came as Satan in some form, and the serpent was forced to crawl on his belly as an object lesson. Kind of like the rainbow in the sky, as something in the natural world that would constantly remind man of something. God did this a lot. The Sabbath day was to remind them when they came out of Egypt. The rainbow in the sky. The mark on Cain. It may, you understand what I'm saying? It may not, that may have been what happened. The text permits that. It's not important. What was the appeal of the temptation? Genesis 3:6. Physical, aesthetic, and intellectual. And I put this in because you probably heard this before. You compare it to 1 John 2:16. Where John categorizes sin, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the boastful pride of life. All sin falls into one of these three categories, or more than one, at least one of these three categories. You got that? Lust of the flesh, which is the sensual, often sexual lust. Lust of the eyes, greed, covetousness, that kind of thing. And the boastful pride of life, personal arrogance. Well, you see, physical, lust of the flesh, aesthetic, lust of the eyes, intellectual, pride of life. Well, now, whether you can divide, make those strict categories, I don't know how useful that is. There certainly was the physical, the aesthetic, and the intellectual temptation. It was a well-rounded temptation, at any rate. It appealed to all, it appealed to every part of Eve. And most temptations do. Most temptations are not single-faceted. For instance, we seldom do anything for any single one reason, good or bad. So, good for food, delight to the eyes, is pretty desirable to make one wise. Now, let me comment, although this is not an exegetical course, on this, what sets in. It says the eyes of both of them were opened, and they knew that they were naked. They realized that they were naked. Now, what does that mean? Well, it means that they were naked before the fall, but they became a source of embarrassment after the fall. Why? Now that here, this is a better question than asking about their belly buttons. What is there about that? How can we understand that? I don't know, because I don't. We have no. We have no adult awareness. We have no awareness, because remember, of the sinless state. We cannot know what it's like. I think something very close to it, which helps me understand it, whether it has any connection or not, I can't be sure, but it helps me understand it, is the innocence of a child. The only thing we have to compare, which is analogous, it's the same, because we're talking about adults and children, but a child has to be a child. Embarrassment and nudity is a part of growing up. It used to be, in a way. One of the things I reject, I am insulted, and I, when they call an entertainment where people take off their clothes, adult entertainment, the idea was you've got the adult ones put your clothes on. But you, all of it, every parent has had the embarrassment of you get comfy, you get your kid in the bath, this happened, you get a child in the bath, this 2-year-old, and somebody, a visitor, somebody comes in the front door and he wants to see who it is, so he just climbs out of the tub and joins you in all his glory and her glory. and you're embarrassed, and possibly your guest is embarrassed. The only one that's not embarrassed is the kid. He knows what you're talking about. You know, he's in there, or she, they're just happy as a clam. Kind of like I bought a record up north, and moving down south 10 years ago, we lost it. It was your treasure. It was Ray Stevens, The Streak. A great line. He's as proud as he can be of his anatomy, and he's going to give us a pee. Well, a child is like that. He's as proud as he can be of his anatomy, and they're going to give us a pee. I don't care. You understand? There's no embarrassment there. But as a child grows up and he enters into the world, the corrupted world, the world of right and wrong and guilt, then the natural course of things is for there to be, in other words, guilt produces embarrassment. You know, Mark Twain said that man is the only animal that blushes or needs to. Well, that may be analogous. I do not know. We have nothing in our experience that equates it. So the point is that I think what we see in that is the onset of guilt. That is what guilt does to us personally, as opposed to what guilt, not only guilt before God, but guilt. And it does, you know. Well, any questions on that? All I have to say about that. Then the call to break out of the creation order we've already talked about, to move up, would you like to be like God? And of course, no man fell. But look at the transgression. Now we get down to some real guts in this subject. What happened? What's the nature of sin as it enters the picture? Look at the internal, external, the internal character of sin, the external character of sin, and the essence of sin. Now, this is good stuff. This is important. First of all, the internal character of sin, it is the decision, We're talking about the decision versus the outward act. The decision to sin versus the outward act, the internal character of sin. Look at Matthew 5, 27, 28. You'll remember this as a part of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus says, if you have heard it said that it was said, you shall not commit adultery. But I say to you that everyone who looks on a woman who lusts for her has committed adultery with her already in his heart. Sin has an internal character, regard that is not the same thing as, and not necessarily connected with, the external expression of it. And it is based on pride and selfishness. Sin is an affirmation of self over God. Now, it is pride and selfishness. I hesitate to use the word selfishness because the word selfish in our idiom has a trivial connotation, like a child who won't share his lollipop or his toys. He's selfish. But it's much more profound than that. We say, when we're talking about selfishness in this context, we're talking about a profound affirmation of self in defiance of God. You see, sin produces self-affirmation. That's why Jesus says, if a man's going to be my disciple, what's he going to have to do to self? Crucify self. Deny self. Deny yourself. Take up a cross. What happens on the cross? Well, people die on the crosses. Self-crucifixion. Now this is, so the internal character is based on pride and selfishness. That is, I do not, where we say in effect, I do not care what God says or what God wants. I am so important that what I want outvotes what God wants. An affirmation of self. Now, we could talk a long time about this, but it's interesting that in our, as our culture has become a secular culture, it has become a selfist culture. Selfism is the rule of the day. Whitney Houston sings the greatest love. What's the greatest love? Yourself. Well, that's, and there's an article in the this morning's Sentinel Star on childless couples. And, of course, there's nothing intrinsically wrong with a couple being childless, and that's not a word. But they were talking about why these couples have chosen childlessness, and they give all these fancy... The one word that didn't appear in the article, but which was the theme of the article, was the word self. Selfism. We don't want children. Why? Well, we've got our own lives. They interrupt our, you know. And if you're in the self business, you don't want to have kids. That's true. You can't be a selfish and be a good parent. At work, a lot of kids are ruined because they have their parents take care of themselves. Their parents are more than themselves than they are. And this takes a thousand different shapes and forms. Selfism. The affirmation, be true to yourself, know yourself. And of course the church is into this up to its neck. The affirmation of self. Self-worth, self-assertion, self-affirmation, love yourself. It's enough to gag a maggot. The external character of sin, that is the shape it takes physically or outside, is transgression of the law. Now by the law we mean the will of God, whatever that will of God might be for any age. Paul says, where there is no sin, there is no where there is no law, there is no transgression. Law expresses the mind of God, what God wants. So when a person makes this selfish decision, then and acts upon it, whereas the internal is translated into the external act, it is transgression of the law. The law, the will of God, is transgressed. She took from this fruit and ate. She gave also to her husband with her, and he ate. That was the external act. God said, don't do it. And she wanted to be like God. She wanted to know good and evil. She wanted what she wanted. And he ate. That was the external act. Got there internally. Selfism, the affirmation of sin. I prefer the word selfism to selfishness because the second word has its trivial connotation. internally selfism, externally transgression of the law. The essence of sin, which we're going to talk about later, is the attempt to kill God to take his place. Every sin is an attempt to kill God to take his place. Now, you say, well, do people think that way, that when a person commits a sin, they say, I think I'll kill God and try to take his place? No. We're not saying that that people understand that. It's one thing to say that people understand the essence of sin. But whether people understand it or not, this is the essence of sin, which we'll come back to. Okay. Now, that's the transgression. Now we get to a very sticky issue, which really is important to soteriology, the transmission of sin. Look at the order of our study. We've looked at the beginning of sin, the temptation, the transgression, the transmission. The transmission, when we approach the question of the transmission of sin, what we are asking is this: what is the connection between Adam's sin and me? Does the Bible make a connection between Adam's sin and me? Certainly does. The book of Romans, chapter 5, as in Adam, all die. By the one man's sin, all were made transgressors. Romans 5:12 is the verse, if you want to put that in the syllabus.
Well, it's 5:14.
You
got 5:14 in the syllabus.
Okay. Romans 5:12 through 14 really should be. Therefore, just as through one man sin entered into the world, and death through sin, and so death spread to all men because all sinned. For until the law, sin was in the world, but the sin was not imputed when there is no law. Nevertheless, death reigned from Adam until Moses, even over those who had not sinned in the likeness of the offense of Adam, who was a type of him who was to come. Now, the biblical doctrine, first of all, okay, so you understand what we're talking about, transmission. Very sticky and difficult question of what connection is there between Adam's sin and my sin. Okay, first of all, I point out, the biblical doctrine of sin and the fall makes evolution impossible. Listen to me, I reject theistic evolution. Not the professor there was trying to get me to accept it, and I didn't get into this, but I reject theistic evolution on two grounds, not this, and I give these. And this is not necessarily the order they would come in. This is not necessarily the priorities. But I reject theistic evolution on two grounds. Number one, it's bad science. The question is not what could God have done. The question is what happened. As a matter of fact, what is it? How did things come to be? The second, so it's bad science, but it's bad theology too. And here we are here. Theistic evolution is bad theology. Why? Because I don't care how you slice evolution, you got man rising. And the biblical doctrine is that man fell. It's evolution versus devolution. And I would point out that the physical evidence is of devolution. That's the physical evidence. That is, I deal with this in the history and logic of science, I'm going to mention it here. But the evolution is, you know, like the idea of man progresses up, you know, you start with these Miocene apes, these little lemur-like fellows jumping around the trees, and then you go up to the Africanthera pines, leafy people, Africanthropus and Australopithecus and these fellows. Then you get up to Homo erectus and the Homo sapiens on man, and you get these little 3 feet high knuckle walkers, brachiators, swinging from trees and all that. So you get man. Well, that's not what the evidence is at all. You don't find this nice progression. The field of evolutionary anthropology is an absolute chaos. What you really find is, with man, you find all kinds of extinct creatures and living creatures. You find man at a different level. When man goes like this, Father, you back to go with human fossil evidence, Cro-Magnon, Neanderthal, pre-Neanderthal, second class of fossils, Neanderthal, Cro-Magnon, and modern man. What you find is a general diagnosis, it's a general devolution. Physically, we're talking about physically now. As you know, don't you, that the average skull capacity for Neanderthal is 200 cubic centimeters larger than the average skull capacity for modern man.
You know that?
The bigger brain, not the smaller brain. And man is superior. The biblical picture is the accurate picture physically. Now,
but theologically, that's the biological or the paleontological aspect of it. The theological aspect of it is that man, you see, evolution, I don't care how you do it, simply rules out the fall. There's no way to be a theistic evolutionist with any sense, have any consistency or coherence in your system, and believe in the fall. For instance, one of the real problems, by the way, for the theistic evolutionist, that is, the theistic evolutionist believes that man had a soul. And he had a real problem with neo-Darwinistic gradualism, because the difference in each generation is minuscule. But at what time do you have ensoulment? When did, you understand? When did this simian creature become man? Are we to believe that a parent, for instance, a creature of some kind, somewhere along the line, somewhere in here, on this being, this parent creature was an animal, but their child was a person? The parent, daddy and mommy did not have a soul, but Junior did. But if you look at the difference, but you cannot look and tell any difference between Papa and Junior. You see what I'm asking? So there are all kinds of insurmountable theological problems. It's bad science and bad theology. So the biblical doctrine is not that man started out low and is gradually working his way up. The biblical doctrine is that man started out high and fell precipitously. Any questions on that? That's just a fundamental issue. Okay, the question is, what is the relation between Adam's sin and our sin? I've said this. The physical consequence, of course, is death. We don't have any problem with that. We can dismiss that with a statement. Now, the word death as a theological concept includes physical pain, sickness, and weakness. You understand, death doesn't just mean the act of dying in theology. Death means the package. People do not die of health, normally. The package of suffering, sin, suffering, weakness, physical, everything involved in physical disintegration, deterioration, age, all that is death. You understand that death is just the final result, or the end. It's not, death is a process. You realize, don't you, the moment you're conceived, you start dying. There's anybody in here who isn't dying, he can tell you that. We're all like the cancer patient who's been told he's got a fatal disease. Every single one. You think of perspective. I remember a good friend of mine named Bill Andrews was told he had cancer of the spine. He came to me and he said, Roger, I'm dying. I said, I know. I said, so am I. You realize, don't you, all of us have a fatal disease. It's just a matter of time. Your days are numbered. They tell you that. The difference between you now and the person in the doctor's office today who's been told he has terminal cancer is a very small difference, especially from the perspective of eternity. The difference between 2 years to live and 40 years to live from the perspective of eternity is the difference between 50 and 50 down. That's marvelous if you point of view. Seems significant, and it is significant. Isn't that depressing? Depressing. You know, John Donne was right. Don't sin not to know for whom the bell tolls. For whom does it toll? It tolls for thee. As every time, what he's always saying, every time the funeral bell rings, it's for you, for me. It's true. Now. And that's if we live out our normal 70, to which we are not entitled by any kind of right. Okay, that's death. Do you understand what I'm saying? So death embraces this whole concept of... The important question is, what is the spiritual relation
or is there a spiritual relationship between Adam's sin and our sin? That's the question. See where we're going on this? Now it gets quite complicated. We've only got a couple minutes left, so I know I'll get started with it. Questions. Now, I want you to know I really appreciate all the questions you've all asked the last 2 hours. I've appreciated most of the questions you've asked the last 2 hours. I appreciated a couple of the questions that you asked the last
2 hours. What was that about the swell sounds?
Neanderthal skulls, on average, the average about 1,500 cubic centimeters in brain capacity. Modern man is closer to 1,300 on the average cubic centimeters in brain capacity. Now, the anthropologist, the evolutionist, would argue it's not just the size, it's the configuration. I would point out that the difference in configuration between Neanderthal and what they pick for modern man is within the range of the total configuration of existing man.
Yeah, I say we have a difference.
Got that? By configuration, they'll say, well, it's not just a question of how big the brain was, but how much of it was frontal, and, you know, the configuration of it. And what I'm saying is that the difference, that both Neanderthal and modern man fall within the range of modern man. There is no, well, they tend to pick out a particular shape of skull configuration and say, this is modern man. And we don't know what the range was for all of man. I think that since man is genetically deteriorating, it's certain to me anyway, that man has, from the beginning, had a greater capacity for variety in skull shape and size and configuration than he has now.
What about all these skulls that they say are way back, way before the end?
Some of them are pre-flood man. Some of them are just extinct apes. And there's quite a gap. You can tell the difference between the two. Quite a gap between the two.
Between the pre-flood man and the
ape? I play a little trick on this when I'm lecturing on this at seminars. I show these profiles of skull, which is very flat, has a heavy superorbital ridge. And I show this, and then I show another skull which has a very, almost no superorbital ridge. The skull goes up and very rounded like modern man. I point out that this is, shows clearly, you know, ancient man versus modern man. The trick is that the well-rounded modern skull is Leakey skull 1470, and the flat one with the brow ridges and the Australian Aboriginal with a PhD, the last I heard he was still alive. I do that to drive home the point that when they give these comparisons, they're very selective. And if you make other selections, then this nice neat little thing doesn't work out at all. So, that is, modern man has great variety. This, even today, you know, there are a lot of people living around today. They died and buried, somebody dug up their skull. They had no way of dating it. Didn't know where it came from. They swear it was Australopithecine.
Because it was a fit what the program they said it has.
Yeah, that's my answer too. But then the general I'm saying was in Neanderthal, the skulls are, and Cro-Magnon was physically superior to modern man, because he's after Neanderthal. There's a whole class of skulls that never get in the textbooks, at least not in the pictures, which are pre-Neanderthal, which are older than Neanderthal, but which are modern. And the reason they don't get in the Sacrifice story, fossils, the Ariosaur fossils, other names of some of them. And they don't get in there. Why? Because then you would show an angle from modern to Neanderthal to modern, and that doesn't look nice, so they just leave them out. It's like when they get the Australopithecine class, they switch them around. They'll show, because you have a creature that's more primitive, they didn't say, that came later than a more gracile or modern one. They just changed it, switched them in the order. They got later ones coming, earlier ones coming, but after later ones, regression, so it looked better. It's a fraud. I told my professor at the university, who's the head of the anthropology department, I took this Time Life, you know, almost said, and I said, I said, creationism, notwithstanding, nothing to do with creationism, just the viewpoint of anthropology, this is an absolute fraud. And he said, well, of course it is.
Are you done?
Yeah, I'm finished.